repeated cycle of a lot of sunspot activity, a lot of storms on the surface of the sun. It peaks and then it bottoms out, and then 11 years later it peaks again. So that's the underlying principle of the sun throwing out a lot of ionized gas and other things and high energy photons. They excite gas layer in the atmosphere and ionize the gas. Ionized gas acts like a lens, and it bends electromagnetic waves like a lens does. So if you have the different layers, especially the ones designated F1 and F2, when they are excited by solar radiation enough to ionize, they refract sky wave radio waves and bend them back towards the surface of the Earth. And sometimes they can bounce off the surface, go back up to the ionosphere, and be refracted and bent again. And the ultimate result is that those radio waves can hit the Earth at different locations, repeatedly, going up, down, up, down, up, down. If you pour too much energy into it, you not only ionize the gas in the F1, F2 layer, but you can upset the structure of the ionosphere and disrupt its physical characteristics. It's sort of like, rivers of ionized gas flowing in the ionosphere. If geomagnetic storms are powerful enough, even though you've ionized the gas, you've disrupted the shape of it, and it no longer is a calm ionized river and not able to refract the way it does when it's not disrupted by geomagnetic storms. So does that give you a good indication?
Absolutely perfect. Absolutely fascinating and well said. If you bear with me for a moment, let me locate my next question. This is Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf, standing by.
Okay, no problem, we can wait.
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf. Are you still up?
I'm still here, Sam.
You ready for the next question?
Yeah, sure.
Well, everybody talks about 10, 15, 20, 40, 80, possibly 160. What their bands in between? How much activity are there on the other bands, whether it be 12 or 17 or whatever? I mean, how is the distribution of activity regarding these different bands? Back to you, Roy.
KC2GS. Okay, what you're talking about are usually described as WARC bands. Those are later frequency allocations to amateur radio operators that, way back to earlier on, we didn't have access to them. It sort of depends on the time of the year and also the sunspot activity. As was mentioned earlier, 12 operates very much like 10 meters, and 17 is sort of a cross between 20-meter characteristics and 10-meter characteristics. So, those particular bands are more active in the summer than the winter. They're more active during the height of sunspot activity than the lower portions of the sunspot cycle. And depending upon, contests and all kinds of things, There are people who love the WARC bands. There are others that never got around to putting antennas that are even resonant at those frequencies, so they don't really talk about it. I'm sort of surprised that almost no one talks about 6 meters, which is a long time band that hams have, and should be in times even better during the sunspot peaks. And that's where you, in the old days, people used to tell all kinds of great fish stories about 6 meters, but almost no one mentions 6 meters these days for some reason. But I mean, the WARC bands are you know, there, and if you have an antenna that's resonant, you know, you might as well, you know, frequent them and see what kind of activity. Again, you know, with 17 and 15 and 12, you know, it's very much like 10 meters, but it's not as wide, so you have a much better opportunity.
PC?
Yeah, Rich?
I mentioned on 30 meters is CW and digital only. And for CW, I love it because it's not as busy as 40 meters, less in the CW portion, and it's not as crazy as 20 meters. So if you work CW, try 30 meters. It's a lovely, lovely clean. When I say clean, you know, the signals are really spread out on it. That's what I mean by clean. I love it for CW.
Okay, yeah, I mean, they all have their different characteristics. So one of them is channelized, so it's more like CB than it is ham radio, because you don't really perceive most of the ham bands as having channels. They just have ranges of frequencies, and you could go in between two and not get the dirty looks from anyone. But, yeah, I mean, the WARC bands have their own fans, and people use them, and you know, if you want to upset some fans, threaten to take away the WARC bands, and you'll kind of recognize that people have an interest in it out there. So you know, you should try it at least before you decide that it's not for you.
Special to Yankee Duff, Roy. I have a couple of responses, but hold on a moment, please. I'll be right with you.
Okay, no problem. By the way, our own John from New Jersey, KD2BD, he can't get through the repeater, so he can't listen to it, and he responds through the chat box. And he had a couple of little entries about the HF propagation. He said, "Poor HF propagation. We're entering into the summer doldrums again. It'll clear up in October, just like last year." Well, that's my fear. He says there's a highly technical paper that explains the phenomenon, and he offers the link. And he said, as we get closer to solar maximum, like now, the change in maximum usable frequency between the summer and the winter intensifies. So he had some comments. Of course, if you want to take a look at the link to the research paper, just type in chat.ac2gs.com and open up the chat room, and it's sitting there.
Echo to Yankee Golf.
Okay, welcome back, Sam.
Thank you, and sorry for the interruption. A couple of notes going back a couple of paragraphs ago. You mentioned 6 meters. Well, that's when I was a ham, and 6 meters was the big time for us novices. It's really interesting, as you pointed out, that the talk about 6 meters today is really very, very little. The other thing that's interesting is back in the day, 220 was like really obscure, and yet today it's like part of every VHF, UHF kit that you can buy. So it's interesting that 220 replaced 6 meters in terms of the hype. I appreciate the 2 cents about the 30 meters and CW. That's very good to know. So thank you, W2BC. And Roy, my only question to you is what bands? That's interesting. Those bands I never heard of because I never realized that they didn't exist, I think, when I was a novice in the 60s. Back to you, Roy. Thank you.
You're welcome, Sam. Yeah, that's the whole point. These are relatively new acquisitions that I don't remember what year. It could have been the 70s or the 80s. But, you know, there was a time when you were just getting into the hobby when these were used for different purposes and they were reallocated. And some adventurous hams have been playing around with them. Others just stick to the bands that they're used to. I have to somewhat disagree with you about the 220. There are very few UHF, VHF radios that are tri-banders. They do exist, but they're in the minority. I think if you go to the major manufacturers like ICOM or Yaesu, they're dual bands. So it's a little difficult to get a 220 tri-band transceiver, and it's to my understanding, it's not that popular. The club, Limark, has a repeater on 220. I think they have a repeater on everything and every mode. And there are occasionally activity going on, but it's a lot less activity, as far as I'm aware, than 2 meters or 70 centimeters. So 220 is still a thing, not a very popular thing. Usually, you know, a couple guys get together and they get some tri-band radios and some antennas that are tuned for 220 and they hang out with each other, but it's not as popular as UHF or even VHF.
Absolutely correct. I stand corrected. Anyway, thank you, Roy. I think they're starting to change that. I wanted to share with you that on YouTube, I watched an hour of this guy walking through the Dayton Hamfest 2025, and it was absolutely well done, and I highly recommend it. I'm sure you would enjoy watching it on YouTube. So back to you guys.
Okay, very good, Sam. I have to check that out. Thank you for participating. Thank you for your questions. I appreciate it. And I look forward to future questions in future TechNet. So thank you very much, Sam.
Roy, you are the best. Thank you and good evening.
Thank you very much. Yes, David.
Can you put me on the list?
Sure, I'll put you on. Wesley, how you want to play this? You want to give David your slot, or you want to use your slot? Because you would be the next person up.
Well, that depends. It's 21:14. If it's not going to be another half an hour or an hour, don't think that's why not.
Okay, so David, you know, you can't take up too much time because I don't want Wesley to feel as though he's squeezed for time. But you can go next.
QSO, 5 minutes, guys. Okay. I have a Yaesu Fox Tango 60 Romeo handy talkie. And for some reason, the battery would get really heated up, you know, over time when I was transmitting. What do you have to say about that?
Well, that's not unusual. It's dissipating current, and eventually the energy has to go someplace, so it's dissipated as heat. It's a It's a function of a bunch of different things. It's a function of the output power you have set, the duty cycle, how many times, you know, what percentage of a given minute is you transmitting versus receiving. And also it can be part of the characteristics of your battery. All batteries have internal resistance, and as the current flows, that resistance is turned into waste heat. So there are better designed batteries with lower internal resistance, and vice versa. So if you have a battery that is required to throw a significant amount of current, but it has a significant internal resistance, you're going to get a warm handy talkie after you transmit for a while. You know, you can't kind of break the laws of thermodynamics. So you might want to consider a fresh battery. Sometimes if it's the internal resistance, a new battery might improve the thermal signature, or you might just kind of lower the power if you don't need all the full power, or consider the duty cycle that you're putting the handy talkie under.
So, I have two other handy talkies that don't heat up. They don't heat up at all. The ICOM handy talkie and the MD380. Also, you can transmit almost indefinitely, you know, without the battery heating up. The Baofengs, I'm not sure. I think they get a little warm, but they don't get, like, out of control. Then I looked on the internet about the Yaesu handy talkie. They said that I should try a different antenna. And, you know, I took the WD-40 deoxidizing spray and sprayed the port where the antenna goes in, and put the antenna, also made sure there was some deoxidizing spray on the antenna, and I put it together, and I think I solved the problem. We were talking about SWR and the radio heating up.
Okay, I guess if you have a significant mismatch of your antenna, some of the RF could just go back into the handy talkie. It's not necessarily the battery that would be doing that. It just would be the reflected signal on the transmission line.
Yeah, I tried a different antenna. Somehow I think it's working much better. I think the receive is better too.
Well, I mean, that would make sense. If you have a mismatch or a problem with connectivity, you'd have a reciprocal problem both in transmit and receive. Not with the same characteristics, because you'd be getting less power into the receiver circuit, so it wouldn't have any thermal signature to speak of with receiving as opposed to transmitting. Then, you know, then if, you know, something like 20-30% of your RF signal is bouncing back, that's a lot of power that has to be dissipated as waste heat.
Yeah, so yeah, I'll take it out into the field and see, you know, if it works better. Thank you very much for your word. This is KG2RY.
Okay, thank you very much for your participation tonight, David. And I hope you figure it out and come back and share it with us. It's a little bit difficult to really discern unless it's a significant difference. Very few people have calorimeters that really give you an indication of heat dissipation of equipment. So it's going to be one of those, well, it's hotter or it's cooler or it's nice and cold, you know. The significant differences, you know, human senses can assess. But, you know, you're not going to get any particular number that the calories per minute went from X to Y. But good luck, and thank you for participating.
Sure thing. Yeah, I think just to be in a conversation with somebody, you know, on the go, just walking down the road and having maybe a 5 or 10 minute conversation, I would know if the battery is heating up or not, you know. And maybe it's a little bit warm, maybe it's as hot as it was before, and hopefully I solved the problem. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day, David. Wesley, you're up.
Okay. Just let me know, how am I coming out? Am I too soft, or you want to increase the volume?
Yeah, I'd increase the volume a little bit.
I didn't hear your response.
Because I didn't hear your signal previously. Is the transmitter just put out an empty carrier?
How is it coming out?
Now it's fine.
Okay. So we have a few subjects to discuss, starting from the first one. It's 9 CM EME, 2025, and that's the report about it. So we're talking about the very much unusual contest. It is a contest on that 9 centimeter band. So not every ham radio operator possibly know what is a 9 centimeter band. The 9-centimeter band is a portion of HSF microwave radio spectrum internationally allocated to amateur radio and amateur satellite use. The amateur radio band is ITU regions 1 and 2 and is between 3.3 GHz and 3.5 GHz and is available only on secondary basis. And of course, our president is doing a lot of different moves, and it is a notion, a quite credible notion, that it is a recommendation of removing the amateur service from this band in order to make a room for 5G cellular system. Let me drop. We have uncertainty, but at the same time, we have a Canadian ham radio operator who was trying to make participate in the contest, and I'm trying to look at what is his call sign. And he was able, in a short period of time, to make VF G4, so England, Poland, SP6, OH, and WA6PY. So even though that we're talking about a very, very, very minuscule power that is being used there, that contest was quite successful. Any comment, or maybe comment of Dr. Ray?
I don't have anything particular to say about it. My contests are great. Moonbounce is fascinating. It's one of my last-ditch comments to make to younger people who aren't impressed by amateur radio operations. You know, you tell them that you talk to Japan, and they pull out their cell phones. But you can't tell a ham that you bounced your signal off the moon. So we have that remaining feature of our hobby.
The thing is that real-time TV is available at this band too. So we're talking about sort of like commercial TV, but made by amateur for amateur, because...
Well, usually most of the digital television that I'm aware of takes place on UHF because it's more accessible than microwave, and it has very wide bandwidth, and you could use up a large portion of the bandwidth and not get into trouble with other people. Unfortunately, it's not that active. Andy, WA2CDL, was a big fan of that type of mode. He had a couple of people he knew who had setups to do it, and they would show it off during field days and such. And then, you know, some of those guys got to be in their mid-90s, and, you know, they weren't able to repair their devices, and unfortunately Andy became a silent key. So there's very few people, to my understanding, on the East Coast who are into analog or digital television. The closest that you get is slow scan, which isn't quite the same.
Okay. The next one. So we have USO FTX 1, and now it is ready to be purchased, but there is zero on stock. So it is approved, it is being sold. There are guys who purchase it, and there are guys who make a presentation. But the interesting thing is that now, because of a very much uncertain situation in the United States with the prices, probably, USO decided to make something that will allow them to save money. So, USO FTX 1 and USO FTX 1 Optima is actually the same radio with different power. So if you look at the mold, the plastic mold from both radios is exactly the same. So the radio is actually the console, and if you want to have 100 watts from it, you just plug additional power supply the amplifier. That is the part of the radio. But if you buy the QRP FTX 1, you wouldn't be able to just buy another part for it, because that part comes with the connectors, and I don't believe it was a purpose. Let me jump. Okay. It was the purpose for the manufacturers to deliver a head that would eventually be converted to Optima version. So, the FTX-1 has two BAC connectors, and the other connectors are blank. When you look at the Optima version FTX-1, then you see that all of other connectors are active. And Yusuf said that they're not going to make extension cables, so you cannot have the radio in any other place. I don't see the reason to unplug the radio at all. It doesn't make any sense at all. So that would be it for it. Just to wait for your comment.
Well, I would assume they think their customers might be interested in running QRP portable, and when not, they plug it in together and they get the full power.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. So in other words, if you intend to have two radios out of one, use only QRP portion of it with a display for SOTA or POTA. And if you want to have a little bit more power, then you can have the digital module connected to the radio. But if you decide to use it as a QRP, you have a special battery, and you have an option for the battery that is included in the package, or extended battery that you pay a little bit more money for it, and they give you that battery that allows you to have 5 to 9 watts power for extended period of time, but we do not know how for how long. Back to you, Dr. Wayne.
Yeah, ICOM has a similar all-in-one QRP radio. If you run it on the battery supplied, I think it gives you 5 watts. If you put it into a 13-volt power supply unit, it'll put out 10 watts. And there's always talk of them building a linear amplifier that plugs in the back that has a similar opportunity to run it as 100 watts instead of just 5 or 10. So it's not like Yaesu invented the wheel. You know, they just said, gee, that guy has a nice model. Let's copy it.
Okay. So the price for the radio is $1,899.99 in HRO with discount. The discount is $1,886. Now, depends from dealer to dealer, the price may fluctuate from $1,899.95 to $2,400. I assume nobody is going to sell it for $2,400, but there is a zero of them available right now to be purchased. So they were there, but they are not there. And so the radio finally arrived. Latest details on Kenwood D750. So we have a new Kenwood 750, and I sent you the video screenshot from the video. Then they have something that looks like a very fancy walkie-talkie, very quite a big one, like the old cordless phone, and I have no idea what it is. Unfortunately, I was busy whole day and I didn't have a chance to look for it. I wonder if you were able to look at it. Back to you.
Well, I watched the video you sent me. It was very confusing. A middle-aged gentleman who didn't appear to know much about the model was announcing its existence and little else. So it was rather strange. You know, you have some guy ask him a question, and he says, I really don't know. And someone asks him another question, and he said, I really don't know. And the only thing he came up with is it's very, very similar to the user interface of the 75 handy talkie that's Kenwood, probably the most expensive handy talkie that you could buy these days. And the previous model, the D74, had a fatal flaw. If you turned it on while it was sitting in the charge bay, you blew out a chip. I know at least one guy who had to basically replace the chip because he refused to pay the price for a technician to do it for him. So hopefully the D75 doesn't have that flaw. But, I don't see the point of the D750. And the guy presenting it didn't know much about it, so he didn't know what the point was.
Thank you very much for viewing that video for me. I was busy for the whole day, so I couldn't find more about it. And, of course, we have a Hamvention 2025. And it's Friday, Saturday, Sunday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And the last day, that would be today, it was only to 1 p.m. So probably we're going to have a few guys on the TechNet who would say I was there, but I decided not to go there. I didn't see anything special. We had a few guys from the club who were frequently visiting Dayton, but it wasn't me, but you, the tour.
Okay. I wonder perpetually at the lack of communication skills of manufacturers of amateur radio gear. It's sometimes significantly difficult to find out about things. And we have to rely on kind of badly made videos of hams wandering through conventions and taking these videos with their cell phones in odd conditions. So I wish they would be more upfront. I mean, even Flex Radio pre-announced that they have two new radios, but I haven't seen pictures of them yet, and at least the YouTubes that I've watched haven't shown them, so I don't know why no one either cares or knows about them. They don't really sound like great new models. Their major feature is that they don't use a power supply. They plug into a wall outlet. They have a built-in power supply to power the 500-watt final transmitter stage. So it's just it's either a very powerful transceiver or it's a transceiver with a linear amplifier built in. So that's something, nothing that I particularly am interested in, but it's something that someone might be.
Yeah, there are many new gears on the Dayton convention, and it was 2 hours video that I sent you, so somebody's interested, you can go to YouTube, and on YouTube you could see what's going on there, or what was going on for the past 2 days. Some guys spent a good money. I decided not to. Yes, I would love to have the 7760 icon because I like it, but as Roy said, if you have money, you can spend it. I don't. Another one is update never grant ham radio equipment. So we've been doing it for so many times, for so many years. We were talking about granting and not granting radio equipment, and now we have a video that is has a title update never grant ham radio equipment on YouTube. Update never grant ham radio equipment. So if you put it in your browser, you're going to see that video. And the reason that I decided to say a few words about it is, let me read the quote. Under the video frame, a question, what is the best way to make a lightning rod and attract a lightning strike? Answer, ground your antenna. An absolute electrical code violation in U.S. He grounded his Shag equipment. He followed ARRL advice on grounding. So that was actually why I decided to come out with it again. ARRL advice on grounding. Lightning hit the ground and dropped high voltages across the two unbounded ground rods and destroyed every piece of equipment in his shack. There was several kilovolts across the power line, and it is illegal in the United States. Gosh, is it? I would say I have a very good electrical experience. I don't know the recent code that would say that you that by grounding you're violating the electrical code. But anyhow, Dr. Roy, your comment.
Well, I said it before, I'll say it again. About 50% of YouTube's about amateur radio are nonsense. This is not up to code. This is not up to the ARRL specification. The way that he described the grounding, he grounded on two non-bonded ground rods. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to bond. If you're going to ground them to ground rods, you have to bond the ground rods, too. So, his YouTube is worth the same thing as my used tissue paper.
Okay. Oh, of course, I agree. You don't have a 2 grams or 3 grams or 4 grams or whatever you have voltage potential between the ground and the conductivity of the ground is different at each point. So, absolutely, there should be one common ground for all of the grounding. Although it is very much inconvenient for many guys. Any comment?
Just that generally speaking, life tends to be inconvenient.
That's right. Okay, the next one. Tech mind. So the way that you hear it, tech mind, if you put it into YouTube, there was a new channel. They've been not long, but they have a very much condensed, precise and concise videos. At least it looks like they have precise and concise videos with something that I would say is not okay, and here and over there is not okay, but in general, the guy doesn't give you the stories, the guy doesn't want to entertain you, the guy wants to just give you very much condensed information. So, Tech Mind is the video channel that I recommend to ham radio operators. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay, I don't have an opinion one way or the other. I watched a portion of one. I didn't really have time to go through them. The vast number of their that they have concerned me a great deal, because we're living in a terrible time of mediocre artificial intelligence, and there is software out there that if you give it an idea, it will generate a voice synthesized presentation. And if you're real lazy, you could go over to ChatGPT and say, you know, give me a topic, and not even have to think about the topic. And these voice synthesized, one of the dead giveaways is common words that almost no one in the United States mispronounces. AI voice synthesized mispronounces. I didn't notice that the one video I played had a synthesized voice, but others could. I don't know. There's a slew of that. You know, there's a lot of YouTube videos that just talk about AI slop. And there's a ridiculous amount of AI slop on YouTube and elsewhere. You know, at first people think it's cute, but after a while it gets kind of tedious. I mean, you go to TikTok, and there's this one guy who apparently does remakes of famous movies with the characters reduced to child versions of them. And that runs through a couple of AIs. You could probably generate a couple of dozen of those scenes using readily available AI, and these guys pocket good money for slop like this. So, you know, this particular guy, and I have nothing against him, I really haven't taken that much time to assess the value of his YouTube. You always have to be concerned about YouTube, because, especially with ham radio, like I mentioned 10 minutes ago, at least 50% is nonsense. I don't know why it's that way, but there seems to be a lot of people who think they know stuff when they don't know anything in our hobby, as opposed to other subjects, you get the similar type of thing, but it's nowhere near the 50%. At least that's what I've discerned in my experiences.
Interesting. That's a good idea to view more of those videos and check, because the tone of the voice is exactly the same in all of the videos. And it might be a very realistic voice that is presenting you very condensed information. Now, how good that information is, that's another story, but it is very condensed. So usually when I talk to you or to the audience, I'm making a stop, I'm thinking, I'm adding something, and this one is like a smooth. So that might be a synthesized voice. But
well, I mean, it could be a synthesized voice, but it could also just be a script. I used to use scripts.
Oh, okay. So, Tech Mind on YouTube. If you want very much helpful, then another one: Hypersonic Mind Missile Defense by Cross Polarization Jamming. Yeah, I wasn't really trying to make something difficult to understand for the audience, not necessarily interested with it, but when we're dealing with hypersonic missile, we're talking about seconds, and we're talking about absolutely incredible speed, and we're talking about almost no means of being able to shoot the rocket. So the time of the detection of that missile is important, because a minute later, 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, I mean, imagine that we have a speed of 3,500 of miles per minute. So, okay, depends from, what hypersonic missile we're talking about, because some of them just took the name. So there is a way, and the scientists came with the clever idea, and it was a device that was tested, and I sent to Roy information about this hypersonic missile defense by cross polarization jamming. So cross polarization, imagine that you have a Yagi antenna, then you have a crisscross Yagi antenna. So like two of the antennas in one. One is vertically, or the one is horizontally polarized. But then, if you were able to rotate that antenna, then you're actually making a cross polarization plus antenna that is circularly polarized. Even though that you didn't use helix physically, so that is disturbing the signal that is coming to the missile, because the missile has to not only receive the data about the direction, but also being able to process it. So actually Russians and all of the Chinese, they didn't have to think much. They just took our electronics and our chips to make it fast and make it good. Just a little comment.
Nothing much. The video kind of went into a little bit more detail that I think most people are interested in. He was discussing how you have to decelerate because of the ionized gases covering up the sensors for detecting the target. And I don't know. It was like I got into the wrong technical discussion room in a hallway.
So I'm going to say a few words. The cross-polarization jamming is a novel jamming technology with a good effect on conventional nanopulse radars. By theoretical analysis, the angular measurement error can reach the half a beam with however the polarimetric array fusion monopulse radar can obtain the angular measurement through the two polarization arrays. I'll work on the maximum likelihood estimation of the target angle to achieve the final angular. In this way, the radar can have its anti-jamming capability improved. In other words, everything is inverse square laws. If the rocket is coming to your direction and you are the person who has the radar, then the closer it comes, the more distortion it creates. Unless it's badly programmed, and then you can do nothing about it. So let me go to the next one. And the next one is AI in court, and I leave that to Dr. Roy. We discuss a lot that matter, and so for the first time in New York court, AI was used, and the judge not only approved that, but he changed the sentence. If I'm not mistaken, he gave 1 year more in prison to the person who said he's gonna use AI to defend himself. So if that goes this way, then we know that the lawyers are not gonna make so much money. But I love the opinion of Dr. Roy. Dr. Roy, back to you.
Yeah, ACDGS. It would be sort of like if I decide to do a puppet show of the deceased who was murdered, forgiving me for murdering him. It's nonsense. I mean, I don't understand that at all. But human beings aren't particularly rational creatures. So they did an artificial intelligence computer simulation hologram nonsense of the victim, forgiving, if I got it right, forgiving the plaintiff. It's a computer program. You can have them do anything, you know. You can have O.J. Come back from the dead and said, tell everyone that he didn't kill anyone. I don't understand it. Other than making the news, there's very little legal value and very little intellectual value in this particular story, in my humble opinion.
KG201.
And the next one would be Alice. A-L-I-C-E. Alice detects conversion of lead into gold in Hadron Collider, LHC. And I hope Dr. Roy had enough of time to go to it and could comment on it. Back to you.
Yeah, Wesley David wanted to say something, I think.
Okay, so I just wanted to say I have a 5-minute question.
Okay, we're coming to the end of Wesley's list, so we'll be out of this in probably 5 minutes, and we'll put you on next. How's that?
Thanks, Dr. Roy, KG201.
Okay. You want me to talk about Alice? I mean, transmutation is sort of a known thing. It would be ridiculously expensive. You could only make, picograms of the stuff, so you know, given the price of gold these days, that would be probably less than a penny's worth, and it would probably cost you rental time of a couple million dollars to rent all the equipment to bombard lead nuclei.
Actually, you repeat my thoughts. I think exactly the same. So head on lead in collision in hydrogen collider, the energy to produce a quark, a gluon plasma, the majority of particle interaction during GLC, ion run, the quark 98% or near miss. So in those cases, even though the two nuclei never touch, a strange thing can still happen. While the lead atom are neutral, the lead ions inside the hydrogen collider have been stripped of their electrons. So usually when you have a nuclei, then you have electrons. In the old times, at the beginning of 20th century, it was orbital electrons, an old orbit, the cloud of electrons. So they have we may say there is a bare nuclei and we have a collision. That means that there is nothing to balance the ions of 82 protons, that is called warping positive charge, generates an extremely strong electromagnetic field. This field is even more concentrated by the LHC extreme speed and effects of Einstein special relativity, which comprises the ions into pentane. So that was a quote that I read to you from the not so much complicated scientific papers, because there are plenty of material there, and there's something that is said on in the language that is quite not complicated. It's head-on-head lead collision in hydrogen collider. There have the energy to produce a quark gluon plasma. The majority of particle interaction during that collision is a lead ion that runs more than 90%, and the results from what are actually near the misses. So one thing that we may have a problem to understand is near the misses, but I don't think we should take too much time on the very heavy science. In those cases, even though the nuclei never touch, a strange thing can happen. Back to you, thank you very much, and to XC.
You are very welcome, Wesley. One thing mentioned in that article was that these were very temporary gold nuclei, because they disassembled the gold for a short fragment of time and then continued to fall apart into much more simpler, smaller nuclei. So it was a very few number of gold nuclei, and they didn't have a long lifespan. So, but I mean, theoretically, you can transduce.
Island Mobile Amateur Radio System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
Okay, let's see if I'm back. Yes, I'm back. So the repeater got a little antsy and started to kick links off of itself, so it reestablished them. Anyway, I was going on about Professor Periwinkle on a Superman TV show that I watched as a little child. He had a machine that made gold. Unfortunately, it made it out of platinum, which is usually more expensive than gold. So the criminals that thought that they were going to get rich, it didn't. That's still the problem with gold. You can transmute lead into gold with a very low yield and a very high expense.
Hey,